This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. It's 9 o'clock and time for the Tuesday Radio Zine. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up first on Between the Covers, the guest is MJ Rose, author of the mystery The Delilah Complex. She also sold her first book as an e-book. At 9:30 on Black Book Talk, hear about some recommendations for good books by Black authors. At 10, Jim Thompson speaks with Sarah Sheets of the Multiracial Family Center, a place where multiracial and transracial children and families share common experiences. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, dancers from Body Box discuss the Big Room and the history of Hawaiians in the Pacific Northwest. And at 11 on Democracy Now, a look at yesterday's mass marches for immigrant rights. Where does the movement go from here? Now here's Between the Covers.
MJ Rose is the author of 5 novels. Her latest is The Delilah Complex, a psychological thriller. She made publishing history when her novel Lip Service became the first e-book to be published by a mainstream New York publishing house. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you.
You published your first novel, and it seems like you really had a hard time selling it, even though it became a bestseller. Why was it difficult to sell that book?
Well, at the time, there was no category called psychological suspense, and the book didn't really fit a category description. It was a little too erotic to be not called erotic, but not quite erotic enough to be called erotic. It was a little too literary to be commercial, but too commercial to be literary. It was had some mystery in it, but not really a mystery, and publishers just felt that there was no way that they could market it. And because I was from advertising and that was my whole background and I knew a lot about marketing, I thought that they were crazy.
Well, it seems like publishers do try to get books pigeonholed. And when things don't fit neatly into categories, they kind of don't want to touch them. Why do you think publishers insist that books follow certain forms?
Because publishers really don't know how to market books. And they really, the only way they know how to market books is to basically say, this is like that. And so if this isn't anything like that, they don't know what to say this is like. There's very little research and very little development and very little innovative effort made in publishing to figure out who the readers are, how to talk to them, how to approach them, how to get more readers.
That seems really surprising because it seems to me that the only reason as an author that you don't self-publish is you go with a publisher because they have the marketing expertise.
No. The reason that you don't self-publish is because the publishers have the distribution network, not the marketing expertise.
But now you kind of got around that by having your book on Amazon, didn't you?
Oh, you don't know. You can't really get around the distribution thing. All you can do, you can sell so little compared to what a publisher can do. I can give you some statistics. The average book will sell less than I think 5%, less than 8% of its total sales online.
Really?
Yeah. So if you self-publish, you can only publish, you can only sell online, and so you have very little sales possibility. I sold 2,500 books in six months or something. But, and then, you know, I published the book through the book clubs and the publisher, and they sold over 75,000 books in the next 6 months. So you really can't get the book out there unless you're with a publisher. A lot of authors are doing a lot of their own marketing, hiring their own publicists. I actually run a small media marketing service for authors, because and most of 99% of them, no, actually 100% of them, are all published by traditional publishers.
So what sort of mistakes do you see other authors making if they try to set up their own website? Now, you were successful only because you had the website and you had the ebook, but then it got picked up by a major publisher.
Well, I don't know how to say this nicely. I was successful really because people liked the book. you can do everything that I did, but if people don't like the book, nothing's going to happen. It's just not going to get word of mouth. The secret to this is what you have to do is, whether you're self-published or not, and if you're traditionally published, it's the same thing. You have to get a certain number of people to read the book, hoping that of that number, a percentage will like the book, and then those people will talk about the book. There's a big misconception. Publishers like to say that advertising doesn't sell books. All that sells books is word of mouth. Well, word of mouth sells books, but in order to get word of mouth, you have to advertise the book so people will pick it up and try it.
Right.
But if people don't like a book, you can spend $250,000 on it, and it won't keep selling. And we've had a couple of instances of that in recent years where, that's the tipping point amount of money that you can pretty much get a book on the bestseller list if you spend $250,000 on it.
But you know of some examples where people spent that much money and it still didn't get on a bestseller list?
It got on the bestseller list because of sales, but nobody liked the book and it fell off after a week.
Wow.
So there was an old expression in advertising is you can get everybody to buy a product once with good advertising, but if the product is bad, they'll never buy it again. So they got X number of people to buy the book in the first 3 weeks because there was so much marketing done, but then none of those people continued talking about it. So as opposed to books that we know about, like Secret Life of Bees or The Kite Runner, where the initial push for the book wasn't really very big at all, and it didn't get on the bestseller list right away at all, but over 6 months or 8 months, people just fell in love with the book and kept talking about it and talking about it so much that it did sell.
It gathered momentum.
Yeah.
Interesting. So your newest book, The Delilah Complex, features a sex therapist who becomes involved in a murder investigation and a secret society where women are the sexual aggressors. How did you get the idea of having a sex therapist as your main character? And she was in a previous book, so this is like the second one for her, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a new series that I'm doing. It started in January of 2004 with a book called The Halo Effect, which came out in paperback in July. And Delilah Complex is the second book in the series, and then the third book is coming out in July. They wanted to do them close together to get some momentum going. And the next one's called The Venus Fix. And what happened was my first novel, Lip Service, happened to take place in a sex therapy institute called the Butterfield Institute. And I invented that and did a lot of research on sex therapy and sex therapists, and I had at one point wanted to be a therapist and thought that if I was a therapist, I'd probably become a sex therapist. So it was something that I was really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so then I put my first novel in the Butterfield Institute and was very taken with it, never really forgot about it. And, five books later, I don't know, it wasn't like any one moment that anything happened, but I just all of a sudden had this idea of going back to that place and doing a series about the therapist who worked at that institute. It turned out that so far they're all about the same one therapist, but at some point I might branch off and write some books about different therapists in the institute. But it's a subject that I'm really fascinated with, and part of it is because I used to write screenplays before I started writing novels. And when I decided I wanted to write a novel, one of the things that I thought a lot about was, if I write a novel instead of a screenplay, why am I going to write a novel? Why don't I just write another screenplay if I have a story to tell? So I thought a lot about what the difference between a movie and a novel was and the experience. And one of the things that I realized was that when you read a book, you're actually in the character's head. When you go to a movie, you're watching the character. So if the main difference is that you get to live out the role of the character in the book, then it's a more psychological experience than it is, a more psychological experience than it is in the movie. And if that's true, then you really have to talk about the whole psychology of the character. And if you're talking about the whole psychology of a character, it includes their sexuality. And when I notice that difference, and it's like really convoluted, and I'm sure no reader actually thinks about that stuff.
Right.
Just some of the nutso stuff that writers think about. So I got involved with the psychology of a character, and then from there it wasn't a big leap to, well, what would happen if I started writing about an actual therapist? And so that's what happened.
Well, she makes a great main character because she's got an interesting profession, and then of course she's thrown into this situation where there's these murders to solve, and it seems like a really good way to structure the critical points of the novel, and I'm just surprised that no one else has come up with it before, because it is such a good...
You know, I was so nervous when I was writing the first one before it came out that somebody was going to do it before me, because I was so excited that I actually had found something that no one else had written about. It's not completely true that no one had ever written about a sex therapist before, but nobody had ever written about a sex therapist in any kind of mystery or suspense novel.
Right. So what kind of research did you do? Because as I'm reading the book, it seems like this woman really does know what she's talking about, and as she builds the profiles and stuff, this all seems very realistic. So you must have done a lot of research.
I did. Well, first of all, I work with a therapist on each book. I write the book. I usually talk to her when I start the book. I come up with the idea, and then I talk to her and make sure that my basic precept of the main characters and their neuroses or problem makes sense. And then when I finish the book, I give her the book again to read to make sure I haven't made any mistakes. Actually, I'm really proud because the one that's coming out in July, she just gave it back to me, and she couldn't find any mistakes in it. She said I was ready to go into therapy now. But
you're going to open your own practice?
Yeah, that's what she said. But I've been working with her for years because my first novel was about the same place, the Butterfield Institute. My second novel was about a therapist, not a sex therapist. And so I was working with her back in the mid-90s, and I read constantly nonfiction books about therapy. I spend a lot of time with her. I think over the years, I think half of my bookshelf is books on psychology. So I really am an armchair psychologist at this point.
Right. Well, your books tend to have a strong sexual component. Do you think that you're treated differently as an author because of that?
By publishers or by readers or either?
Either.
Well, I'll tell you what happens to me that does not happen to most people who write suspense novels. People tend not to go up to authors that they meet and say, "So did you really murder somebody? Is that how you knew how to write this?" But I get people constantly saying things to me like, "So did you have all that phone sex? Or did you really ever join a sex club?" So that definitely happens to me and does not happen to other people. For some strange reason, people assume that because it's sex, I've done it, but when it's murder, other writers don't do it.
Right.
So that's one funny thing. I did in the beginning, but I don't now. I think once I got a certain amount of critical success and some good reviews, people stopped treating me like I was doing something prurient. But in the beginning, people had a hard time accepting the fact that if I had this much sex in the books, that they could actually be well written.
Right, right. So do you think you're treated differently because you publish advice on e-books?
No, I mean, I'm not treated differently anymore. I meant I was in the beginning about the sex, but since I've gotten good reviews and stuff, that's stopped.
Yeah, no, I mean about, because it seems like that there's always kind of a different way of looking at people who self-published or who had e-books.
Most people don't actually know anymore. I don't remind people I don't bring it up if it doesn't come up. And for, in the beginning, it was horrendous. Published authors, not readers. Readers didn't couldn't care less. But other authors treated me like I was some kind of pariah, that I had self-published my novel. And obviously, it must have been horrible if I'd had to self-publish it. And bookstore owners thought that I was, you know, truly dreadful. And it was really funny, because I was in advertising, and I knew a lot of filmmakers. And, you know, I was writing screenplays, I was in advertising, and I knew all these independent filmmakers. And there's a whole film festival for people who, quote-unquote, self-publish movies. They're called independent filmmakers, and it's called Sundance. And it's a totally
celebrated
thing to do.
Right.
And so I didn't think there was any difference between self-publishing a novel and producing an independent film. And I was shocked at what the difference was. And it didn't go away that readers were fine about it, as I said, but authors didn't start treating me like a normal author until my third book came out. But my first and second book, I was pretty well ostracized.
They wanted to wait and see how well you did.
Well, it's like my first review for Lip Service said, MJ Rose will never be reviewed for the quality of her fiction, but she'll certainly go down in history as the first author to use the internet to get her career jump started.
Right. But now people are pretty much ignoring.
People don't pay attention to it anymore, because I'm on my seventh book is coming out this summer. So obviously it's not, that's 7 years in the past now. Nobody really cares anymore. And also I should say that the industry's changed. And when I did it, I was the first one, and it was pretty unheard of. But now, every year, there are at least 15 to 20 authors who self-publish who get picked up by traditional houses that now look at self-publishing as pre-marketing. I mean, they really do see it as, if you can self-publish a book and you can sell a lot of copies yourself, they see that as a test market situation.
That's interesting. So do you think you were a pioneer in this area?
Well, I don't like to say things like that about myself, but everybody else has said I am. And Time Magazine called me the poster girl for e-publishing. So,
Doesn't seem like a bad thing.
I did something that hadn't been done before, and you know, for good or bad, it broke down some walls.
Right. Well, it seems like are you spending, like, now that you have, you said you've got seven books published, do you find yourself spending more or less time promoting each book?
The same, unfortunately. I thought when I got picked up by a traditional house, I was going to be able to stop doing it. And I found out with my very first novel that that wasn't true, because I'm from advertising and because that's really, you know, my whole career before being a novelist, I know as much as anybody in a publishing house does about marketing. And I have a lot of ideas. I'm a really creative person, and so I come up with a lot of ideas that no one's done before, and I use them on my own book. And by virtue of the fact that no one's done them before, I can't leave them to anybody else to do. I can't call up a marketing person in a publishing house and say, oh, why don't you do X, Y, and Z for my book? I have to, like, do it and show them that it would work. So the sad thing is that I'm not alone. The sad thing is if you start Googling this and reading about it online, what you'll find is that in the last 6 years, marketing has become something that almost every novelist feels they, and every author, I should say, feels they have to be a part of, that other than the top 2% bestsellers, authors are now all involved in their own marketing.
Why do you think that is?
Because there's a whole little formula, and I'll try to do it really quickly, but these are the basic numbers of what's happened in the last 6 years. There are 50% less reviews done a year than there were 10 years ago. There are 50% less places that review books than there were 10 years ago. In the same 10 years, people have discovered the internet, cell phones, cable, 100-channel cable television, things like Netflix, and iPods and other listening devices. None of those things were prevalent 10 years ago. So 10 years ago, when all these other things didn't exist and there were all these wonderful reviews, there were about 5,000 novels published a year. I'm just going to do this with novels, but it extrapolates out.
Okay.
There were 5,000 novels published a year 10 years ago. Now that there's less exposure for books, and now that there's more things competing with books, there are 10,000 novels published a year. So we have twice as many books with people distracted by seven times as many other things they can do with their time, and 50% less attention paid to books across the board in all media.
Now, that 50% less reviews in all media is kind of a surprising number to me, because I would think things like the Internet would have opened up places for books to be reviewed.
They have been, but they're so marginalized and narrow and niche-oriented that it's hard to make an impact on them. Like, you can easily reach 100 people on a website with a review, but that's 100 people. When the New York Times did, in their book review section, when they did 20 novels a weekend, that book review section reached 4 million people. Now, equally problematic is, because of the Internet, 4 million people aren't reading the New York Times book review anymore. They're all scattered. So it's easier to get a review on a small scale, but it's harder to get one that's going to have any mass distribution. So a lot more authors can sell 1,000 or 2,000 books than 10 years ago, but way fewer authors can make a success out of a career if a success means living off of it.
Right. That seems to be the bottom line. Just
right.
Making a living as an author is getting harder.
So more people can get published, and more people can have a small readership, but less people can have writing as their day job is basically what it comes down to.
I would think that would start to affect the quality of what we get as a product, because it's really difficult to try to write something like a novel, which is a long work and complex, if you're doing it, fitting it in around your day job. I know this is true.
That's an interesting thing. I would say yes, except that in the course of history, so many people have written so many incredible pieces of fiction while they had day jobs that it seems not to be the biggest problem. The quality, I think, issue is greater with the amount that's being published, and that at the publishing houses, there's less time spent editing and proofreading and all those things, and you're seeing more books come out that are sloppier than ever before, and a lot of readers are complaining about that. There's not a lot about all this that's really exciting and promising and hopeful, except for the fact that more people are getting published. And that's good, because it does mean that more people are getting a chance.
Right, but if readership is declining, that's
not good, I know. Readership is really declining. I read a study basically that said that of people who are avid readers, they claim that they're reading 16% to 26% fewer books than they read 10 years ago because of things like the Internet and iPods and cell phones and laptops and all the places that you used to read. Like, I live in New York and take the subway and the train all the time. And it used to be that on a train, on the train in the morning, or let's say in the afternoon, because in the morning everybody read the paper. So in the afternoon, going home, I'd say 70% of people reading a book. And now maybe 5% of the people are reading a book, and the rest of the people are either listening to their iPods or on their laptops or on their cell phones.
Right. There's been a huge rise in audiobooks.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of audiobooks, and I think that we're going to see a major renaissance in audiobooks in the next couple of years, because there are 30 million people right now, and it's going up like crazy. But today, there are 30 million people in the United States that have iPods or listening devices. And audiobooks are fabulous to listen to. And I really think that it's going to help fiction a lot.
Right. Now, have your books been turned into audiobooks?
Not yet. I'm really hoping on the next one. The problem has been it's very expensive to do it, and so they tend to only do it with the biggest bestsellers.
Now, I'm kind of surprised to hear that it's really expensive to do it, because it seems to me that that would be one of the less expensive. You know, a CD doesn't cost much.
It's the person. You know, it's that you have to have an actress or actor in a studio reading that whole book.
Ah, and then that,
and
yeah.
It has to be recorded, and it has to have it all has to be mixed, and, you know, all the things you do, it all has to be done for that, too, and it's, you know, 12 hours. Plus, it has to, in a lot of cases, they have to be, they're always abridged. I mean, there are unabridged and abridged versions, but the abridgment takes a lot of time.
Ah, interesting.
And they're up till recently, and this is another thing that's going to change, there was a very small market for them because they mostly were either you rented them or you took them out of the library. But people weren't running around buying them because they're kind of expensive. But now that they're digital audiobooks and you can download them straight onto your computer and then onto your iPod, more people are getting involved in doing it, in recording them and selling them. The only problem is the prices are still out of whack. The audio publishers are still pricing them at the same price as a hardcover book,
right?
Which is crazy because you can't put it on your shelf and it's nothing. It's a file. And I've been writing a lot in my blog about how the fact that they should charge for audiobooks basically what they charge for mass market paperbacks, and they'd sell a lot more of them.
Right. Well, it seems like you have lots of advice for the publishing industry.
I do. I wish they would listen. No, actually, I have a lot of things that I've actually talked about have changed. So I'm very hopeful that more things are going to change.
Okay. And so let's talk about your next project. We don't have a lot of time here, but the next book is coming out when?
My next book is coming out. I actually have two books coming out this summer. One is called Lying in Bed, and it's actually an erotic novel. It's out of the series, and it's different kind of thrilling. But my publisher was starting a new line, and they asked me if I wanted to try to do one that was no suspense, just sex. So I'd always wanted to do it, and I'd always had an idea for it. So I wrote it. It's coming out in June.
Now, see, that seems to me to be ideal for an audiobook.
You know, it is ideal for an audiobook. It absolutely is. But I have to call my editor, my agent, when I get off the phone with you. Actually, I haven't done anything about it, but she really should be pushing it.
Right. Okay. And then the other.
And then
book?
In July is the third book in this series with the sex therapist, and it's called The Venus Fixation. And actually, it's about something. Twist on something everybody's talking about. It's not about predators online. It's about teenage boys who are addicted to webcam girls. And there are some murders, and it's pretty creepy, and that's coming out in July.
Okay, well, that sounds great. I'm Marianne Barisonic, and we've been talking with MJ Rose. She's the author of 7 novels. Her latest is The Delilah Complex. And MJ, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
This is KBOO, your community-owned radio station on 90.7 FM. It's 9:30. Up next on the Radio Zine, we have Black Book Talk, the monthly show focusing on books written by black authors. And stay with us at 10 o'clock. Jim Thompson speaks with Sarah Sheets of the Multiracial Family Center, a place where multiracial and transracial children and families share common experiences. And then at 10:30 on stage and studio, dancers from Body Box discuss The Big Room and the history of Hawaiians in the Pacific Northwest. Coming up next, it's Black Book Talk.
When I was young, yeah, my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the streets. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school, scared to go home. I was a fool with the big boys breaking all the rules. Said tears with my baby sister. Over the years, we was poor than another little kid. And even though we had different daddies, the same drama when things went wrong, we blame mama. I reminisce on the stress I caused. It was hell, hugging on my mama from a jail cell. And who thinking elementary? Hey, I see the penitentiary one day. Running from the police, that's right. Mama catch me, put a whoop into my backside. And even as a crack fiend, mama, you always was the black queen, mama. I finally understand, for a woman it ain't easy trying to raise a man. You always was committed, a poor single mother on welfare. Tell me how you did it, there's no way I can pay it back. But the plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it. Dear mama, tell us it was fair. No love for my daddy, cause the coward wasn't there. He passed away and I didn't cry, cause my anger wouldn't let me feel for a stranger. They say I'm wrong and I'm heartless, but all along I was looking for a father, he was gone. I hung around with the thugs, and even though they sold drugs, they showed a young brother love. I moved out, started really hanging. I needed money of my own, so I started slanging. I ain't guilty, cause even though I sell rocks, it feels good putting money in your mailbox. I love paying rent when the rent's due. I hope you got the diamond necklace that I sent to you. Cause when I was low, you was there for me. You never left me alone because you cared for me. And I can see you coming home after work late.
Can you hear him?